and welcome. Catholic Answers Live, and a very happy St. Patrick's Day to you. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, in my green shirt because I don't want to get pinched. And your call's welcome today because it is open forum. Both hours are open forum. And it's another one of those, what I think of as like a super open forum. Jimmy Akin, first hour. Tim Staples, second hour. That really is an impossible combination to beat. So go ahead and dial now if you've got a question about the Catholic faith. 888-318-7884. Everybody's welcome. We encourage folks who are not Catholic to call. If you have a question, if you got something that just doesn't, maybe sticks in the craw a little bit, you're not wasting our time. Sometimes people are like, well, I'm not Catholic. I don't want to waste their time. No, no, no. We'd love to talk with you. If you have a question about Jesus or the Bible, or in the case when Jimmy is on, as in this hour, anything else in existence, 888-318-7884. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of this book right here, The Bible is a Catholic Book. Jimmy Akin, thanks for being here with us.
My pleasure. Dehuit, Cy Kellett.
Dehuit. Dehuit. Mm-hmm. I'm looking to see if anybody knows. Is that Hebrew, or does anybody?
It's not Hebrew.
Dehuit. I don't.
No, you just wished the audience a special day. What special day was that?
Oh yeah, it was Happy St. Patrick's Day.
So, using general intelligence based on context, what language would I then greet you in?
Irish.
That's right. Dehuit is Irish Gaelic. It means God be with you.
Oh well, thanks, Jimmy. Thanks very much, Dehuit.
And the classic response is Dishmerowit, which means God and Mary be with you.
Oh, Dishmerowit.
Mm-hmm.
And you said Irish Gaelic. Are there different kinds of Gaelic? Is that a...
Yes. Historically, there have been multiple kinds. The other major one that people may be familiar with is Scottish Gaelic.
Oh, I see. Oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you, Jimmy. Thank you for that blessing to start us off with.
No problem. They even used to speak some Gaelic in Turkey.
Why did they speak Gaelic in Turkey?
Because that's where Galatia is, and that's where some of the Gauls were. Oh. And so that's why Paul writes a letter to the Galatians. They were a Celtic people.
Ah, well, what do you know? The number here, why am I giving out the number? The line's all just filled up, but give it a try later. 888-318-7884 as we work our way through the callers. 888-318-7884. And if you're in Ireland, you probably go to the top of the line today, right? Is that how that works? If you're in Ireland, the truth is, if you're in Ireland, you go to the top of the line anyways on every other day too, as long as you're the only international caller, because international callers go to the top.
Yeah.
Jimmy, also the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, new episode will drop tomorrow, and that will be
part two of an interview with physicist Dr. Edwin May on research that has been done into whether psychic functioning exists, and if it does, how it works.
Again, our number here, 888-318-7884. Is there any possibility, and I feel like this is going to be like almost like a Deepak Chopra question, but if there could be things like remote viewing or psychic phenomena, could it be related to spooky action at a distance? Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, there's actually a lot of talk about that in paranormal literature, because quantum mechanics operates in a counterintuitive way and is claimed by various interpretations to have inexplicable simultaneous action at a distance. There have been attempts to relate psychic functioning, or to interpret psychic functioning in terms of quantum mechanics. However, a lot of that is really sloppy. And as a physicist, Dr. May is not a fan of talking sloppy about physics. And so he's kind of held some folks in the paranormal field held their feet to the fire a little bit for trying to overly relate things to quantum mechanics.
Well, fair enough. It's kind of, there is a, I don't know. I suppose a naive way to look at quantum mechanics, or maybe it's not so naive, but where everything, because quantum mechanics is so weird that you just relate anything else that's weird to that must be related to quantum mechanics. All the weird stuff is, we'll just throw that in the quantum mechanics pile.
Although it's historically relative, because quantum mechanics is not the original time that science has involved something that was considered spooky action at a distance. That actually is something that has been with us since the 1600s, when Isaac Newton introduced his crazy, crazy, insane theory of gravity.
Oh, yeah, that nutty old Isaac Newton.
Yeah, because according to Aristotelian physics, there has to be a medium connecting objects in order for one object to have an effect on another. So how could like this supposed gravity from the sun affect things here on Earth across a vacuum? That makes no sense. That was the original spooky action at a distance. And it was considered spooky in a pretty strong sense, because at the time, the term science had not yet been invented, not in the modern sense of the term. And so if you claimed to be relying on principles that were unknown, like gravity, but hidden in nature, as part of nature, you were said to be practicing natural magic. And so Isaac Newton was accused of being a natural magician.
Oh, yeah. So, well, that makes sense. Yeah. It's wild to think about something as basic as gravity is just so hard to... I mean, even to notice it, like to be the guy, the first guy that goes, wonder why stuff falls down, when almost everyone else who's ever lived has just gone, it just does. It falls down.
Well, they had an alternative theory for that. Going all the way back to Aristotle, they thought that everything in the world seeks its natural place. And they thought the earth, which is made out of earth, is at the center of the universe. And so if you have something solid, it's got earth in it, and it's going to try to seek its natural place. It's going to fall down towards the earth.
Oh.
Whereas if it's like fire is very light. It's way up. Its natural place is way up in the sky, and that's why fire leaps up. So they would explain things in terms of objects seeking their natural place based on what they're made of. But then Isaac Newton said, hey, you know, if you do the math, it looks like we could explain both why things fall down here on Earth and why the planets move the way they do in the sky if you assume that there's this magical gravity force that's causing that to happen. And so that was the first grand unification in science, the realization that the motions of the planets and the motions of objects you drop here on Earth are caused by the same thing.
That is so, it's wild to think about it. Like I said, you can talk to Jimmy about anything you want. And Jimmy's happy to do it. 888-318-7884. We'll start up in Washington, in Vancouver, Washington. Peter, listening on the Catholic, listening on the website, Catholic Answers Live website. Peter, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
All right, great. Thank you. Jimmy, I've been a fan of yours for a while. Listen to you on this station, listening on the podcast. I've got a question on indulgences, and I read your primer on it, and I'm still a little confused. Can you give me a description of what the consequences would be in this life or after death of not getting indulgences?
Okay, so the consequences, so what an indulgence is a remission or removal or alleviation of the temporal consequences that remain after a sin has already been forgiven. So it's kind of like when a teenager has disobeyed a parent and the parent says, okay, I forgive you. I'm not going to hold this against you forever, but you're still grounded because you need to learn your lesson. And then if the teenager says, you know, I'm really sorry, and they show that they mean that they've really taken it to heart and they're being extra nice to their siblings and they've cleaned up their room and they've done their homework and they're really showing that they have repented, then you might say, okay, you're not grounded for as long, or you're not grounded anymore. And that's essentially what an indulgence is, where the church uses the power of the keys that Christ gave it to remit or remove part of the grounding or the temporal consequences that we would otherwise experience for sin, to teach us our lesson even after God's already forgiven us. And there are various biblical passages I could appeal to show that. Having said that, if you don't get an indulgence and you have consequences remaining after your sins have been forgiven, then you would experience those either in this life or as part of the purification process known as purgatory. So that's the short answer.
Okay, that helps a lot. That's what I thought. So if I would spend more. I need more purification.
Yes, not death. Not the same thing as saying more time in purgatory, because we don't know how time works in purgatory, but you would need to be purified of additional things, basically of the disordered attachments we have to things, the temptations we have. That's what purgatory is purifying, according to the Catechism of the Catholic Church and John Paul II.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter. It's interesting when you say we don't know how time works in purgatory. Because, I mean, there's obviously some form of time there. I'm just hoping, but it would, well, I'm hoping this will not be the case, but it would make purgatory more purgative if there's a time change in purgatory. If like twice a year, you got to change the, whatever the equivalent of a clock is there.
Well, you can take that up with the heavenly court and see what they decide.
Because it just the mere frustration of it would be purgative for me. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, Catholic Answers Live, right after this.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Catherine Hadro and her team of pro-life experts shine the light of truth on the culture of death. You can stay informed and educated with the latest news and truth when we send you EWTN's Pro-Life Weekly directly to your inbox every Friday. Don't miss an episode of EWTN Pro-Life Weekly. Visit EWTN.com and click subscribe. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's Open Forum this hour and next. Second hour, Tim Staples will be here. And earlier in the week, David was in to talk with us about Society 315. As a matter of fact, on the 15th, because that's the day Society 315 started. And in the course of that conversation, I told him that I was afraid of Christine Venditti. And now here she is to talk about Society 315.
And I see you're sweating a little bit.
It makes me nervous, yeah. Because I remember when I joined Society 315. It wasn't, you did not ask me. I'm super glad I joined, because you get the t-shirt and you get all these wonderful communications and all this great stuff happens. But I believe you walked into my office and said, when are you joining Society? Not are you joining Society 315? When are you joining Society 315? And I went,
I don't know if I said like it this. Like that.
I went, I think right now. I think right now.
You did join pretty quickly.
Yeah. So tell us about Society 315, why we're talking about it, and what this month holds for Society 315.
Yeah. So you mentioned already, on Tuesday, it was the one-year anniversary of when we launched this monthly givers club. So that's what Society 315 is. It's our monthly givers club of people who support the apostolate at $10 a month or more. And this whole month is Society Month. So we're doing a little push to get more people to join. There's a lot of benefits involved with joining the society. One of them is that you really get to become more closely connected to the apostolate. We send out monthly emails with exclusive talks. We send out codes for discounts on our shop. You get a discount on our conference that's coming up. And this month, since it's Society Month, if you sign up and become a member, we're actually partnering with Halo, and you'll get Halo Premium for a year.
For a full year.
Yeah,
Halo app is growing like crazy. We're very glad to be associated with, because they have our content.
Yeah, they're carrying apologetics questions from us too.
So how do you join Society 315?
So you can join online at casociety315.com. So that's the main place to join. If you're already a monthly donor and you want the society benefits and you don't have them, you can email society315@catholic.com. So if you're already a monthly donor and you want to be added to the society, you just email society315@catholic.com. But if you want to join, casociety315.com.
casociety315.com. One of the fun things we did was we got together with the Society 315 people at the conference. That was a great time.
There were over 100 people that came to that, and it was a question and answer with you, Chris Check, some other members of our executive committee.
We got really good ideas from that as well. We thought that it was going to be like, at least I did. I didn't know how, you know, it's the first time we've ever done it. I thought they were going to just be asking us questions about how do you do this and what do you, but they, it really was a partnership kind of thing.
Yes. I mean,
people had tons of ideas and how about we try this and maybe you could do that and some of which we have used already.
We're going to do it again this year. So if you join and you come to our conference, you'll have the opportunity to sit down with us and talk to us about your ideas. You can also just share your ideas at that same email address, society315@catholic.com. We want to hear from you. We want to know what it is that you like that we're doing. And that's kind of the whole point of this club is to have our donors be more connected with us. So please join us.
And it's we're all called to share the faith. Every single one of us is called to share the faith, as they like to say in the Mission Society. If you're baptized, you're a missionary. And one of the ways to do that is to learn the faith. And that's one of the great benefits of Society 315,
exactly.
Is all these opportunities.
Exactly. That's why we send out the content. And then you have evangelistic opportunity with the t-shirts that we send you as well. It sparks conversations. You can tell your friends about it. And it's at a level that's pretty accessible for most people to join. And we wanted to make it that way so that anyone could do it, whether you're in college or, you know, up through however old. We've got members of all ages.
Perfect time to join, too, because it comes this month with a free premium membership in the Hallow app, CASociety315.com. CASociety315.com. Thanks, Christine. I'm getting less scared of you now.
Thanks, Si.
Back to the phones. Jimmy, thanks for letting us do that. Jimmy, oh, man.
Like I had a choice?
No, we didn't actually give you a choice.
Okay.
I'm sorry about that.
No problem.
I'm going to give this one a try. I hope I can do it. Brandon in Kosciusko, Texas, listening on the EWTN app, Kosciusko, Texas. Brandon, are you there with us? And was I even in the ballpark?
It's pronounced Kosciusko.
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 Gotcha. Cool.
Polish.
Thanks for the help.
Sounds like a company for making shoes from the Department of Redundancy Department, the Kosciusko.
Go ahead, Brandon. What's your question for Jimmy?
So I was watching a YouTube video a couple weeks ago about airplanes, first jet airplanes that were made. And one of the comments below one of the videos was from a Catholic who remembered flying on an airplane as a young boy in the early 1960s, and he remembered being served a meal. Things were more formal back then. And on the meal plate, there was a little sign that said, if we run out of the no-meat course, we have a dispensation from the Holy Father that you are allowed to eat meat. And it was for Catholics.
Wow.
A young Catholic. And so I was curious, did this dispensation exist, and does it still exist? And I'm just going to hang up and listen.
All right.
It definitely did exist, and there are similar provisions today because when people are traveling, they you know, don't have access to what they normally do to eat, and sometimes it can be hard to go meatless, and so the church has accommodations for people who are in that situation. One place where this applies and has for a really long time is seafarers. Whether they are people who are working on the boat, like sailors or other crew, or whether they're travelers, seafarers have been dispensed from the meatless requirement on Fridays for ages and ages, and that's still true today. And there are parallel regulations that have been applied to air travelers. It's been a while since I've looked at the details of the air travel regulations today, but this is definitely in the ballpark. I'd have to check. I mean, it may not be the case that, you get on an airplane for a 15-minute, you know, hop between San Diego and L.A. and you get dispensed for the whole day. I need to, you know, review the regulations in their current form. But, yeah, this is a real thing.
Hey, thanks for that call. What a fascinating and interesting thing. I really appreciate that. As a matter of fact, that's a question I had never heard before. The number's 888-31-TRUTH. Our guest is Jimmy Akin, and it's open forum. Ask whatever you like. Now, up next, Stephen in Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Stephen, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Good afternoon, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Happy to, Stephen.
I have a friend that was asking me earlier this week about the Council of Trent, which I admittedly don't know much about. So I'm wondering what were some good resources to learn more about it. But his specific question is, was there anything enacted or declared during the Council of Trent that was then retracted during the first or second Vatican Councils?
Okay, so the Council of Trent was called for two principal goals. The first goal, and by the way, if you want to read about it, you could get an article length summary of it, for example, in the Catholic Encyclopedia at Catholic.com. So they'll have, if you just Google Catholic Encyclopedia, Council of Trent, that should come up for you. But basically, it was called for two principal purposes. The first purpose was to respond to the various different theological ideas that were being promoted by various Protestant reformers. And because there were a lot of different flavors of Protestantism, even back then, there were a lot of different ideas it had to respond to. And secondly, it was its second purpose was to conduct a reform of the church, to clean up things that needed to be cleaned up and to adjust the regulations to better help the church function better in proclaiming the gospel of Christ to the world. And so in terms of has anything been retracted, well, nothing that the council infallibly defined has ever been retracted, because once it's infallibly defined, it's guaranteed to be true. And so if it's guaranteed to be true, the church is not going to retract that. Having said that, there has been additional doctrinal development over the course of the last 400 years as the Holy Spirit has led the church into an even deeper understanding of the depositive faith that comes to us from Christ and the apostles. And so as a result, the church has supplemented the infallible definitions of Trent with additional teachings that help better explain them and contextualize them. But nothing infallible has been retracted. In terms of and I should also point out, not everything Trent said is infallible. Like any ecumenical council, it taught at a variety of different levels, the highest of which is infallible. But then there are other teachings that, even though they were authoritative, have not been proclaimed infallibly by Trent. Then there's all the other stuff. There's the disciplinary measures that were undertaken as part of church reform. And since changing societal needs affect what laws are most appropriate at any given period in history, the church has continued to adjust its canon law. And this is not a matter of changing teaching, because canon law is not a matter of teaching. It's a matter of discipline, even though there are doctrinal principles that underlie it. But the church has continued to revise and modify its canon law over time. And so there have been things that were regulations of church life at the time of Trent that have been subsequently modified, but not infallible teachings.
And I'm going to leave it there because there's lots and lots of folks on the line. I hope that was helpful to you, Stephen. I will go up to Santa Clara, California now. Bryce in Santa Clara watching on YouTube. You are up next, Bryce. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Si. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, Bryce.
I'm a huge fan of Jimmy Akin, and I really enjoy both your podcast with Mysterious World and your books. But today I want to talk a little bit about an article you wrote on Armageddon. And
okay.
one of the claims you made in there is that it's a very popular claim I hear, and I think a lot of scholars have been using it, that when we see the word Armageddon, it's a Greek transliteration of the Hebrew word for Har Megiddo, which means the Mount of Megiddo. But mm-hmm. I think that might be a problem, because Megiddo itself is not a mountain. It exists today as a tell, but it's never been mm-hmm. a mountain. And potentially a better translation of that Greek transliterated word would be, instead of seeing that gamma as the gar, would be to see it as a hein, and therefore I don't remember the Hebrew word precisely, but you would instead translate it as har, and then the Hebrew word for assembly, because mm-hmm. then it becomes not Mount Megiddo, but the Mount of Assembly, and then suddenly the location of Armageddon changes from this kind of random city of Megiddo to Mount Zion, which seems much more fitting and seems much more plausible. I saw this from a video by an evangelical scholar named Dr. Michael Heiser, and I could send you the link if you'd like, and I was wondering what you thought of that argument.
Yeah, well, I'm familiar with Mike Heiser, and he's a good guy. I agree with him a lot about a lot of stuff, don't agree with him about everything. I'm open on this one, but I would be very cautious here. The term Armageddon appears only in Revelation 16:16, and it does, if you back translate into Hebrew or Aramaic, it does... it's most naturally read as Har Megiddo or the Mount of Megiddo. But there's more to say about that, so we'll talk about it on the other side of the break.
Hang on a quick second, Bryce, and we'll do that. We're coming back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. Next hour, Tim Staples. All lines full, so if you're on the line, hang on. We're going to get to you as soon as we can. More Open Forum right after this.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
What makes your house feel like a home? We'd love to hear from you tomorrow on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Zach, a little bit of groovy music. That's the Thursday groovy music, and Thursday always fun when Jimmy's here and we're doing open forum and playing that groovy music, and all of those things are happening right now. You're welcome to get involved. If you've got a question, give us a call, 888-318-7884. We're on the line right now with Bryce in Santa Clara, California, referring to an article Jimmy recently published about Armageddon, and has an alternate translation of the phrase that we translate as Armageddon. Jimmy, and you wanted to continue your answer.
Yeah, so as I was saying, if you take the Greek term that's used here, Har Megiddon, it very naturally back translates into Hebrew or Aramaic as Har Megiddo, which would mean the Mount of Megiddo. But Mount is a relative term. It doesn't necessarily mean Mount Everest. It can mean much smaller things. In the town where I grew up, there was a basically a big hill called Mount Sequoia, and so any kind of elevation that's notable in a given area can be referred to as a mount. And it's not implausible to understand Megiddo as a mount, because as Bryce pointed out, what it is a tell. And a tell is a kind of thing we don't really have so much here in America, but they have a lot of them in the ancient Near East, because what would happen over thousands of years is that you'd build a town or a city, and these would be small cities because of the size of the population back then, but you'd build a town, and then something would happen, like there would be a fire or a war or something, and it would kind of fall into ruin. So even time can be, just the passage of time could be responsible for this. But then, because you tend to build towns at convenient locations, like they're near a river or they're near a good agricultural land or something like that, you don't just ditch the town and leave it forever. You rebuild. And so what happens was, over thousands of years, as people inhabited the same settlement, the settlement would rise, because you'd have layer after layer after layer of original settlement being built over as people renewed and returned to the settlement. And that is responsible for these artificial hills that are called tells. And so whenever you see the word tell in a Middle Eastern name, like Tel Aviv, for example, it's one of these archaeological artificial hills that we're talking about. And they're very useful for archaeologists, because you can study the history of the settlement by burrowing down and studying what's in the different layers as you go down. The older ones are farther down, obviously. So if you go to Megiddo, and I've been to Megiddo, it's in the Jezreel Valley, which is a big agricultural land in Israel. It's near Mount Carmel. It looks like a hill. It looks like this. It's this big, tall hill. And you can climb up on it, and you can look down through the different layers that the archaeologists have cut away. And it's a fascinating sight. But because Har doesn't have to mean super gigantic mountain, I don't see a problem with referring to Megiddo as a mount in the— it's on the smaller ends of mounts, but it's still something that can be described as a mount. So I don't see the fact that it's a tell as being a problem. On the other hand, some people have proposed that, well, maybe it's not Megiddo itself. Maybe it's another larger mountain that's near Megiddo, like Mount Carmel. Now, in the case of the theory that Mike Heiser is proposing, I've heard him propose it before, the gamma in Megiddo, he wants to say that that's a transliteration, not of the Hebrew Aramaic consonant Gimel, but instead the Hebrew Aramaic consonant Ayin. And, you know, that's possible. And so it could be being— gamma could in Greek could be being used. It's not the most natural reading of gamma, because the most natural reading of gamma would be the equivalent Hebrew consonant Gimel, that both make the G sound. But, you know, you pronounce G kind of far back in your mouth, and that's also where you pronounce Ayin, where you have this, you turn on your vocal cords and breathe in a certain way, and you make that sound. And that's kind of like the G sound. So it could be— it's not impossible, but it's not the most probable reading. If, though, you say, okay, this is an Ayin in the original language, then it's been proposed by a few scholars, not a large number, but by a few, that we would have Har Moed as the translation. And Har Moed does mean Mount of Assembly. Would that mean Jerusalem? Well, there's a certain appeal there to think of Jerusalem as, or Mount Zion as, the Mount of Assembly. But there's also evidence that points in another direction, because when, for example, Isaiah in the Old Testament uses the phrase Har Moed, or Mount of Assembly, he's not talking about Jerusalem. Instead, he's talking about the mountain where God's court is, and he explicitly says it's located in the far north. And it so happens Megiddo and Mount Carmel and various other places are located to the north of Mount Zion in Jerusalem. So even if we went with the Har Moed translation, it wouldn't necessarily point to Jerusalem. And there are other minority views as well, minority translations that sometimes scholars will have proposed, well, maybe there's a typo in the text here, and it really means something else, like Mount of Slaughter or Mount of Cutting Down or Marauding Mountain or Cut Down Mountain or things like that. But the most straightforward and natural reading of it would be Mount Megiddo. And I don't see enough evidence at this point to convince me to abandon the natural reading. That's not to say these other readings, including Mike's interpretation, aren't possible. I just haven't seen enough evidence to be convinced that the straightforward reading should be abandoned.
Bryce, thank you. I'm going to keep moving because every line remains full. Anne in Colorado, watching on YouTube, you're next. Anne, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Good evening. I have a friend who is, and I can't pronounce the word. He doesn't believe there are popes.
He's a Sedevacantist?
I can't pronounce that. It doesn't look like that to pronounce that way. Anyway, he says that Vatican II promoted two heresies, that of false ecumenicalism and religious liberty. And my understanding of what a heresy is something that is revealed by God. And I don't think there is any direct revelation, although there are things about religious freedom and about ecumenicalism, I don't think there's any kind of dogma on it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that he's wrong on that basis, and I was wondering if I was correct. And also, I'm wondering why that group is not a heresy in and of itself.
Okay.
And not just Sedevism.
Okay. So so the answers are pretty straightforward, and you're asking good questions. A heresy, to put it simply, is the refusal after baptism. It's the willful, deliberate refusal to believe, meaning culpably, in bad faith. It's a bad faith refusal to believe a dogma. And a dogma is something that the Catholic Church has infallibly taught to be divinely revealed. And that means in order not just that something is true, it's not just that the Church has infallibly taught it to be true, but specifically a dogma is something that the Church has infallibly taught to be divinely revealed. And there are multiple reasons that Vatican II doesn't teach heresy, but among them are we don't have the Second Vatican Council contradicting prior truths that were infallibly defined to be divinely revealed about religious liberty or ecumenism. And so your friend, the Sedevacantist, either doesn't understand what heresy is, or he doesn't understand what Vatican II did, or he doesn't understand what the Church has infallibly taught regarding these subjects previously. Because it hasn't taught anything that Vatican II contradicted, not as infallible and divinely revealed. Or your friend doesn't understand some combination of those things. So his charge of heresy is misplaced. You are right on that. So why isn't Sedevacantism considered a heresy? Well, it is considered a big problem, but the nature of the problem is different. The definition, what Sedevacantism is not heresy, but schism. And a schism is it's one of two things. It's either the refusal of submission to the Roman pontiff, the pope, or it's the refusal to be in communion with those that are in communion with the pope. And so since Sedevacantists say there is no pope right now, obviously, they're not in submission to the Roman pontiff. They say there isn't one. And so that's why they count as schismatics. But it doesn't deny a dogma to say that there is no pope at the moment. It would be a heresy and a denial of a dogma to say there's not supposed to be a pope. You know, that Jesus didn't found the papacy on Peter. That would be a heresy. But just saying there's not a pope at the moment is not a heresy, because there are times that's true. Like after Pope John Paul II died and before Benedict XVI was elected, there was a couple of days where there was no pope. And it wouldn't have been a heresy to point that out. In fact, the cardinals were very well aware of that. That's why they were electing a new pope. So it's not, you're not denying a dogma to say there's no pope at the moment. If you're wrong, though, and there is a pope at the moment, you're in serious trouble spiritually, because you need, by Jesus Christ's own command, to be in union with that pope. And that's why he put Peter in charge, and why Peter's successors have continued down to this day. So schism, including sedevacantism, is a very, very, very serious and dangerous thing. It just doesn't happen of itself to involve denying a dogma, and thus itself doesn't happen to be a heresy.
Anne, I got to take the break now. I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you very much for the question. Before we head off to the break, it is the annual store-wide sale over at shop.catholic.com right now. Everything on sale, 10 to 25% off, in some cases more than 25% off, hundreds of great Catholic resources to choose from, and you can get $5 flat rate shipping on everything that you buy. So head over to shop.catholic.com, take a look, and if you're interested in taking one of our School of Apologetics courses, look there as well at shop.catholic.com, because they're 50% off through the end of March. Shop.catholic.com.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
You know, we talk story with each of our very unique guests for the whole hour, so that you can go deep with us as you yourself pursue your own story of heroic virtue, and as you pursue intimacy with God.
The Bear Wozniak Adventure, Saturday night, 6 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
I'm actually having a good time this hour. I'm actually looking at the clock right now. I'm realizing, oh my gosh, we've only got Jimmy for just this segment, and then Tim comes in. So still lots of folks on the line. Lines have stayed quite full. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, as I just mentioned. Tim Staples will be in second hour. And you're welcome to call with any faith-related question you have. Maybe it's a moral question, maybe a question about the sacraments or about the person of Jesus or the Bible. All welcome. 888-318-7884. We'll go to Andy in Missouri next, listening on Catholic Answers Live, our website. Andy, thanks for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
My question has to do with the story of Moses, and mm-hmm. I got really curious about when they were talking about how the Egyptian magicians could sort of mimic some of the miracles, or some of the, I guess, I don't even know if they'd be miracles, mm-hmm. but some of the things that Moses was doing or God was doing, mm-hmm. and it just got me curious about, like, what are those magicians doing, and where do they get their powers, and, like, I just am so curious, so I'll let you answer.
Okay, well, one thing to be aware of is that the Hebrew text, and like it talks about this, for example, in Exodus chapter 7, and the Hebrew text does not use the modern word for, or does not use a Hebrew equivalent for the modern word for magic. And the reason for that is magic comes from a later period. The term magic comes from a later period in history. If you read in the New Testament about the Magi who visited Jesus at the time of his birth, or actually a year or two after his birth. But if you read about the Magi in the New Testament, the word for an individual who belonged to the Magi is Magos. And that's a term that comes from a Persian tribe that was sort of a priestly tribe in Persia. And like any priestly tribe, they had rituals that they would do. And so the term magic comes from that. That's where it comes from. And originally, magic was, okay, those rites that the Magi do. And then it became broader than that to like, well, okay, if anytime someone is doing some kind of foreign, unapproved rite, that's like what the Magi are doing. It's foreign, it's unapproved. We're going to call that magic. And so magic, and I have an episode of Mysterious World on this. I think it's episode 87. It's on religion, magic, science, and psychic phenomena. And it talks about the distinctions between those. But basically, magic is like a foreign, unapproved ritual, or at least an unapproved ritual, usually foreign and shady. But that's a meaning that the term had around the turn of the first millennium. The Exodus, though, is 1,200 years before that. And so actually, the Hebrew text of Exodus uses a different term to describe what the Egyptian, quote-unquote, magicians are doing. It doesn't use the word magic. It uses the word lat, which means secret. And so it simply says that these Egyptian figures were using their secret arts to do this. And that is a little bit broader than what we would think of as magic. It can include not only something genuinely supernatural, it could also just include secret trickery, like what we would think of as illusions or stage magic. And so it could be that the Egyptian officials in this case were using genuinely supernatural abilities, in which case they presumably would have gotten them from demons because they're bad guys. Or it could be that they were just using stage magic, that they were using trickery. And in fact, if you go to Egypt today, there's actually a rich tradition of stage magic in Egypt. And I've like watched Penn and Teller doing a special about magic in Egypt. And you will find snake charmers in Egypt. And you will find snake charmers who work with cobras in Egypt. And often the cobras have been defanged or devenomed, so they can't actually hurt you, but they will be working with cobras. And in an Egyptology course that I listened to with Egyptologist Bob Breyer, he talks about going to Egypt and meeting a snake charmer and saying, "Hey, do you know this like snake to staff trick?" And the snake charmer did.
Oh, wow.
And he was working with cobras. He grabs a cobra. He holds it underneath the base of its head and squeezes. And the cobra becomes rigid. So it's, you've got the head like the top of a staff, and you've got the body dangling there rigid like the body of a staff. And then he lets go of the cobra, throws it on the ground, and it starts wriggling around like you would expect. So he's like squeezing it really hard, but you can do this trick with a cobra. And so it could be the case that when Moses comes in and legitimately turns his staff into a snake, that the magician said, "Oh yeah, we can do that too. Let me just step in the back room here and get my other staff, and I'm going to bring it out, and boom, see, same thing." And he just had a snake in the back room.
Wow. Andy, what do you think about that?
Well, that is really helpful. I do have a follow-up question, if I can.
What's that?
First of all, thank you. That was a really good answer. I'm curious when you said that if it was actual supernatural powers, then it was from demons because he was a bad guy. Does that mean that there's no other way to have supernatural powers? Like it has to come from, I guess I'm just, full disclosure, I'm not Catholic yet, so I'm still learning. So sorry if any of this sounds kind of like ignorant. It's because
it doesn't.
I am.
I'm trying to learn.
Yeah. So at least the way Christians have traditionally understood the supernatural world, there's a good camp and a bad camp. The good camp is God and his angels and the saints. And then the bad camp is a group that rebelled against God, and that's led by Satan and his angels, who are the demons. And in Christian history, most Christian imagination has not seen much of a middle ground. It's a kind of, you're either with God or you're against God, the way it's usually envisioned. Now, having said that, there are some authors in Christian tradition who have speculated about the possibility of neutral angels, or angels that kind of lean one way or the other, but they're not rigidly on one side. And so there has been speculation on that, but most Christian authors have seen things as pretty black and white in the spiritual world. And so that would point us towards, if this is supernatural, it's not coming from God because it's working against God, and that would suggest demons. But if there are other options, like maybe there are some angels who are kind of in the middle, they're not wholly bad, well, then maybe they could have hooked into those spirits. That's a possibility. Then there are other possibilities as well, not about the supernatural, but about the paranormal, what goes beyond what's normal for humans to do. Because you will find doctors of the church, like St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, who believed in what we today would call psychic powers. Augustine and Aquinas both believed in precognition, and Aquinas believed in what we would, not only in precognition, but in what we would call psychokinesis, which is the mental influence of matter. And so there also has been a place in the history of Christian thought for belief in this paranormal that's different than the supernatural. And so I just kind of want to sketch that out as, that's kind of the idea space that Christians have traditionally worked with. There's the purely natural, which is stuff we can do regularly. According to some authors like Augustine and Aquinas, there's this paranormal realm. And then there's this supernatural realm with God and the saints and the angels. But if you'd like to learn more about some of those distinctions, check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and especially episode 87, I believe, on religion, magic, science, and psychic phenomena, where I talk about the distinctions between those.
Thanks, Andy.
Well, thank you so much.
Maybe we'll get to talk again. Let me get at least one more caller on before we have to go. Let's go to Daniel in Las Vegas, Nevada, listening on Catholic.com. Daniel, you're going to have to be kind of quick if you'd like an answer from Jimmy.
Okay. Hey, Jimmy, I just wanted to ask, is it lawful to inflict pain on ourselves for penance, the use of a cilice on the body, or the fatimaseers hurting themselves with rope seems to be like a sin on the body? Could you explain why these practices are not condemned?
Well, they would be if they're being used to excess. So if you're doing serious damage to your body for no good reason, then that's something you shouldn't be doing. And extreme mortification that causes permanent damage without a proportionate benefit is going to be condemned. And that's one reason why you should never undertake significant physical mortification without a spiritual director, to make sure that you're not doing it excessively and that it is producing the spiritual benefits that you want it to. On the other hand, you know, no pain, no gain is a common saying. And so it's legitimate to cause oneself to experience some pain as a form of discipline. That can include things like fasting, as long as you don't starve yourself to death or harm your health. It could include things like wearing a hair shirt, which is itchy and uncomfortable, but was a common form of penance historically, including in the Bible, wearing sackcloth, for example. And so wearing various things or causing minor pain as a form of self-discipline can be legitimate, but you need a spiritual director to make sure that you're not overdoing it and that it is producing the effects that it's meant to.
Daniel, thanks for getting that question out quickly. I appreciate it. Jimmy, thank you for another fine hour. We'll see you tomorrow for 2 hours of Bible questions for Jimmy Akin.
See you then.
All right. See you then. Tim Staples next. Your call is welcome. Two lines open right now, 888 888- 318-7884. Open line means open to any question you have about faith or morals or religion in general, and open to anyone. You certainly don't have to be Catholic to call. 888-318-7884.